Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on New Books in Intellectual History, we have Dr. Tony Bolden, an associate professor of African and African American Studies at the University of Kansas and the author of Groove Theory, The Blues Foundation of Funk, published by the University Press of Mississippi this year. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bolden.
Well, welcome, Professor Williams, and thank you for having me.
Oh, you are. Thank you for agreeing to sit for this interview. Groove Theory is an enlightening narrative on funk music and African-American history and culture. First, we will discuss Dr. Bolden's biography and some thoughts on intellectual history in general. And then we will engage in a more detailed discussion of his book, Groove Theory. Dr. Bolden, tell us some more about your educational research and teaching background.
Okay, well, I'm a little different from most academics in a number of ways, but so I'm actually from the San Francisco, Oakland Bay Area, but my intellectual background is really in the Deep South, in particularly in New Orleans. And I was an artist before I became a scholar. So I was my first models, you know, what I knew of as intellectuals were writers. And this was, you know, they weren't, today people say creative writers, but They were students of the world and ideas. So they were writers. This was called the Congo Square Writers Union in New Orleans. And that was an outgrowth of Black Art South, which was another earlier writers collective. And that was the writers workshop for the Free Southern Theater, established by John O'Neill, Doris Derby, and Gilbert Moses in during the Civil Rights Movement in Mississippi in 1964, I think. So, so I was really active as in theater and as a writer, and so my scholarship really comes out of that. And my first book was called Afro Blue. Was really a study of African-American poetry and music. And so those writers the actors that I knew were, those ideas really reflected in the first book that I wrote.
So I want to back up for a minute and go back to this question. As you said, you had sort of an unorthodox, entry into, writing, teaching. And so what made you decide to become a professor? If you, it seems like you were among writers and intellectuals already. producing.
Right. Yeah, well, they were really, you know, like one of them included the civil rights lawyer, Lolis Eli. He passed not too long ago, but you can look him up. And, you know, I remember we went to a book talk one time after a professor. I went to Dillard University in New Orleans, and this guy had actually taught a class that I was in. Monty Pulaski, I think his name was. He had just published his book, and you know, the lawyer knew more, you know, about the book, and they had to shut the talk down. So they were really people who read and knew a great deal. So the thing about me was, so the whole thing about the professor, it's interesting you asked me that. Actually, what happened at that time, there was a whole big thing. So, you know, the writers group was connected to a larger alliance called, you know, Black Cultural Alliance it had a lot of these independent Black theaters, community-based, you know, groups in the South. And we would meet twice a year for performance conferences, et cetera. But basically what happened is a lot of the opportunities started to dry up. And one of the, you know, one of my, you know, three mentors, is a poet scholar named Jerry Ward. All of us who come out of the South, Howard Ramsey, Charlie Braxton, we were all, you know, mentored by Jerry. But, you know, Jerry had seen me one day, and, you know, he speaks in a very proper voice. And, you know, he says, "Tony, you know, I'm concerned about my English majors. What are you going to do, Tony?" You know, I said, "Well, I don't want to do anything. All I want to do is read and write." And so he said, "Well, you know, Tony, you know, you should go pick up a master's degree somewhere." So I then went and got a master's degree in what was then called Afro-American Studies. But I actually decided to do the doctorate program when it just became clear that, you know, that there really weren't alternative ways to develop, you know, and there weren't a lot of opportunities to publish and do things. So actually that was, you know, so that's the honest answer to your question is that I became an academic. That was sort of the, you know, that was the consolation prize for me. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, it speaks to, I think, your work in many ways in this whole notion of what do we mean when we say the term intellectual. And I also wanted to ask you about your teaching. What courses do you currently teach?
Well, I am completing a course that I have taught since I've been here at the University of Kansas, which is the Introduction to African-American Literature, a fun course, you know, and students usually enjoy that. I'm also teaching, finishing up a course that I've taught for the first time here called Black Music as Literature. So I'm actually reading, we're actually treating the songwriters as writers, as poets in and of themselves, as storytellers in and of themselves. And that covers rhythm and blues. I actually started with the blues, but we ended up with hip hop. So we get blues, a little bit of blues, you know, rhythm and blues, particularly a lot of Prince, which resonates with a lot of my kids here. And then we shifted, you know, to hip hop. So those are the two courses.
Sounds interesting. And I would agree with you. I think these young folks will probably definitely gravitate to courses like the ones that you teach. Now, this raises a question. Our next question is, how did you as a scholar of literary studies come to study American music culture, and it seems like you answered a part of that. But say some more about this relationship between literature and song lyrics. I mean, was it, I think Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So there's some obvious overlapping dimensions between these two sort of genres of art. So tell us a little bit more about, and you get into this in your book, which we're going to revisit part of this question, the relationship between literature and song lyrics.
Yes. Well, okay. So for me, that begins early on. So my very first, the very first time I met, I was the baby of the group. So I was the youngest member of Congo Square Writers Union. But the very first time I went to one of the meetings, after that, we went to what now it's closed, but a famous and very important blues club in New Orleans called Dorothy's Medallion. And, you know, the then Walter Washington, he called himself Wolfman, but he was in his prime then. There was also a singer named Johnny Adams, and who was featured. These were every weekend, and I don't know if this was during the weekend or what, but they were regularly featured. There was also a plus size new dancer that was featured. This was a real live blues club. They don't make these anymore. These are all black folk, no white folk in there. And so it was very clear to me, very early on that music was significant to writers who had this sensibility. It's a bit different from, they're very different, in fact, from the creative writers of today that, you know, people who go to school to write, but a very different sensibility at you know, different audience, different value system, different aesthetics. And so in order, I was already interested in music, you know, part of what I talk about in the book, the very first story that I tell, you know, is before I get to New Orleans. But what these older people taught me was that in order to understand, to have a really firm grasp of you know, what they were doing and what how they envisioned literature and black culture and the precepts therein, you needed to have some real understanding of blues in particular. And so so that's what happened. So that's like at the outset. And so what happens to me or with me is that I published Afro Blue, which is my first book. And I thought the book, what I would set out to do was demonstrate that there was a kind of relationship, you know, a stylistic relationship between, you know, a certain trajectory of black poetry in the 20th century and music making and the music styles, et cetera, blues, jazz in particular. At the end of the book, though, I realized that there was something more. So essentially, you know, I had figured that there were these correlations and I documented those. But I said to myself, if the poetry is reflecting ideas that are expressed and inscribed in the music, if that's how I, you know, explain the poetry, then what's the explanation philosophically for the music? Unless we just want to say, you know, all black people got rhythm, right? You know, that's the, you know, but I mean, you know, philosophically, how do you account for it? And that's what, you know, I began to think about funk. So there are actually references to funk in Afro Blue that, you know, if you actually know how to look for it. But that's how I became interested, you know, in funk. So for me, groove theory is like, you know, philosophy for the people. And but it was a long, so it took a long time because I actually had to become familiar with musicology in order for me to provide explanations for, you know, what was happening on a theoretical, conceptual level. I needed to actually teach myself, you know, musicology and ethnomusicology, because my background was, my PhD is in literature. You know, I can't play a single instrument. So I had to teach myself. And a lot of funk is actually philosophical too, in and of itself, you know. So it was really difficult, you know, book to write.
Yeah, I see it as a work of intellectual history, and that's why, but it's more than that, it's many things, right? It's music history, it's intellectual history, it's Black cultural history. And I think that's the broad appeal. I mean, this book could easily be, it could easily be used in several courses, not only literary or literature courses, but history, I think music courses. And so this brings us to this phrase, intellectual, in which you use in part of the title of one of the chapters. How would you define the term intellectual?
Well, basically, that which has to do with the generation of ideas and understanding. It's interesting that you asked me that, because I do see, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, probably distinguishes my discussion of funk from, you know, some of the other scholars, like, although Ricky Henderson, the pioneering scholar, you know, does engage with it and gives you, you know, an introduction. But there's also Francesca Royster and LaMonda Horton Stallings. But I actually do try to ask, how is it that we began to use this term? How does this term come to mean what it means to us now, and how is it that, you know, funk artists came to use that term of all of the words in the English language to you know, describe what they did. And so it is, you know, in a very real sense, you know, a variation or a species of what I might call Black vernacular, you know, intellectual history. And part of, you know, the project was to redefine, you know, what we understand as intellectual. So when you look the word up, because I, you know, when you asked me that question, I said, well, I'm going to see what the definition is. So it says something about, you know, that relating to intellect and all of that and understanding. But then the definition that it gives you that I saw basically pit or sort of distinguish between feeling and rationality, between thinking and feeling. So that feeling was one thing, and thinking, that is, you know, intellect, is like opposed to that. And within the context of funk, or, you know, more specifically blue funk, you know, that comes out of the blues tradition, it was just the opposite. In order to understand how to play, in order to play the music the way it was supposed to be played, you had to feel. There had to be body movement, you know. And so, yeah, in a very real sense, it is, you know, intellectual history. But I treat all of these artists as organic intellectuals in their own right.
Yeah, and I think the point to be made is the definition comes out of a Eurocentric framework. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about African-American intellectual history, we're talking about a distinct tradition of knowledge production. And so the Eurocentric definition does not necessarily fit, you know, what we're trying to get at when we're looking at a distinctive tradition of people who are producing knowledge. But at the same time, have an affinity for the value of emotion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we miss, I think, when we say, well, intellectuals are people who have 3 and 4 college degrees and they mm-hmm. write things down. Mm-hmm. In a Eurocentric sense, that might be the case. But when we look at, there are many types or forms of intellectualism. And we might say, well, traditional intellectual versus organic versus activist, mm-hmm. and they overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And so my next question for you is, well, what connection does your work have to intellectual history? We got into that a little bit already, but would you define your work, this book, Groove Theory, as an intellectual history of the funk?
Well, that's sort of how the press, you know, engages it. You know, I just say it's philosophy. My characterization is that it's philosophy for the people. That's, you know, and in that context, you get a number of things. So there is clearly, you know, a kind of study of the concept itself. That is maybe the glue that you know, of the book, you know, that I actually approach it as a history of the concept. But in order to tell that story, there are a number of other things. So one of the subtexts of the book, you know, that I don't talk about, that I didn't mention, is that I also see the songwriters as poets. You know, I think George Clinton's a great poet. You know, Sly Stone actually referred to himself as a poet. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean, obviously, what, you know, people who write books, that kind of poet, but sort of like you said, you know, there are different types of poetry. And our ideas of what that meant didn't really change until this became professionalized. There's a really important book called The Understanding of New Black Poetry, actually written by arguably the most influential poetry critic, you know, of all, and name is Stephen Henderson, and he actually includes song lyrics in the anthology. So yeah, you get a bunch of different things. You get analysis, you get interpretations of the songs, you get histories, you get political, you know, discussions in relation to the songs. So that's why I just say it's philosophy for the people.
Yeah, and it gets into history of ideas. I think the Groove Theory does a lot of things at once, which is fantastic. It does a history of ideas and individuals that you hold up as organic intellectuals and knowledge production. It gets into so many different facets of intellectual history that it has a series of subfields within it. But it seems like you're engaging in multiple subfields at once within the context of the book, which makes it, I think, ever more fascinating. Let's turn to the book more directly and tell our listeners about the scope and structure of your book and what you mean by the blues foundations of funk.
Okay, well, so the book is divided into two sections. So I use the metaphor of an old, you know, LP. So you have side A and you have side B. So side A is groove theory, conceptual foundations of funk. And section two is I think it's devotion, blue funk and the black fantastic, but there's also an intro and outro. So the book has the intro, three chapters. One is, a sort of the first chapter talks about the epistemology of funk, which was actually the first subtitle. And I was told, well, no, you can't say that because nobody will know what you mean. But so epistemology is the production of knowledge. That's what you've been talking about. And so essentially the first chapter is the sort of how to, from the standpoint of the musicians themselves. And I talk a lot about the role of feeling. The funk principle is the interplay between motion and emotion. Like George Clinton says, defines funk is if it makes you shake your rump, it's the funk. So, it's an analysis of, that kind of interplay between motion and emotion. And, I use various, songs and scholarship to, talk about that. The next chapter is called Blue Funk, The Ugly Beauty of Stank.
And yeah, I love your subtitles.
So this is the story of how the concept, is developed within blues culture. So, for example, because we all think of it as something that happened in the 1970s, and it's really an old concept for people listening. The great blues artist Bessie Smith, was apparently going to a party in her honor, and she was with two of her girlfriends, and she, in the old days they would hire piano players, to play at the party. And so she heard the piano player and she's digging that sound, and she turns to one of her friends, she said, "The funk is flying," and so and even before that the term was used. So chapter two is an analysis of how the concept gets developed in blues songs by jazz musicians who extend the blues idiom or the blues tradition, and so it's sort of like pre-funk, if you will. And then the third chapter deals with Sly Stone and his contribution. He's a really important figure in a lot of different ways. And so the next half deals with very specific artists. So there's Chaka Khan, Gil Scott-Heron, and Bette Davis. And in the outro, briefly, I discuss Michelle Ndege Ocello and some of my, just a brief kind of comment on the meaning of the term now and the implications that artists are still using this term and everyday people, you know, in the 21st century.
So let's go back to the beginning of your book and, you know, where you're defining the term funk, and you use this phrase, aesthetical practice. And can you elaborate on that a little bit in terms of your definition of the funk and this phrase, aesthetical practice?
I think that's one of the people who wrote the blurb. But I think what she meant by that is so there are very specific, there's a broader funk aesthetic. That's where I'm going. I think that's what she's connecting with. So if there is that the music of the 70s of Betty Davis, of James Brown, of Parliament Funkadelic, Earth, Wind and Fire, that while these musicians were, you know, sort of emblematic, if you will, of the meaning of funk, the concept is really broad. And in fact, one way to think about the importance of you know, these musicians, we tend to think of music primarily in terms of entertainment. But I think it's maybe a better way, or another way at least, of thinking about it is as the centerpieces or the central figures of an aesthetic practice or an aesthetic framework, so that you can observe in other artistic mediums. So, you know, during the late 60s, early 70s, and thereafter, to some degree, you can see the principles, precepts, or images, or allusions to funk music. So in other words, concepts in the music and or figures associated with it in a number of different artistic forms. Visual art, that is to say painting, literature, you know, and obviously dancing, but specifically visual art and literature. So that's what we mean by I talk about a cultural aesthetic, that there's actually a way to pinpoint there are specific principles and images that are related to funk that we can observe in Black writing, for example, and you know, in certain cases, Black visual art as well. So, yeah.
So you've been you know, making this point about the relationship between literature and music. I want to go back for a second to your mentioning of the Black Arts Movement and what the artists were up to during that era. And I think a lot of people fail to maybe realize or recognize that performance art poetry is coming out of the BAM, the Black, you know, arts movement, where these poets are performing as if they were musicians. And they have these compositions that are set to music in which they're performing on stage. And suddenly now, you know, performance art poetry is all the rage, but it comes out of this, I think, what you're arguing, this, you know, tradition of Black aesthetics. The Black aesthetic tradition is producing performance art poetry from the BAM.
Well, yeah, I think, see, this is why I think funk is really important for us, because it actually has to do with another way of, it has to do with the way that people who are influenced, I'll put it that way, because you can be from any culture, but, you know, the ways that we are influenced by African-derived, you know, philosophies and aesthetics. So, so the music was always there, you know, it's just that, so for example, Sterling Brown, Langston Hughes, they were always doing it, you know, experimenting with music. You know, Margaret Walker's For My People, you know, that's very much like a sermon, for example, in terms of the rhythmic pattern. Her father was a preacher, I'm pretty sure. So it's always been there. What happens in the 60s has to do with a determination to address Black people specifically, right? Much more, in a much more conscious way than had been done before. That becomes the primary audience. And they saw that, you know, the preachers and the musicians like James Brown, they had these audiences. So, and these were people who had grown up in the neighborhoods themselves. So that was the attempt. But there was a backlash against that because that wasn't, if we, you know, literature is supposed to be A, B, C, not D, if you will, right? And so I think it's interesting that performance poetry is sort of coming back, so to speak, because of the time that we're in and all of the kinds of issues that are being raised. But yeah, interestingly enough, I think the connection with funk, because all of this comes around a time when you've got the black aesthetic, the Black Power movement. What's interesting about funk is that it was, that it came from the streets, you know. The Funky Broadway, which was a dance before the song that was recorded 1966. So that was a dance that happened at that point. It's at the same time, the next year, the book Black Power by Charles Hamilton and Kwame Ture comes out. So 1967 is when the Funky Broadway song is a hit. And then the next year, another dance called the Funky Four Corners is popular. And James Brown used to dance that. It was very popular in Black communities. So, and before this, that word was stigmatized. You weren't supposed to say it. I like to think that the funk aesthetic, if you will, comes about because, you know, the dancers and young musicians like Sly Stone, who began using it in his liner notes to describe his bass player, Larry Graham, that these young artists, these young dancers and musicians decided that this was their interpretation of Black is Beautiful, you know, because, you know, before this, if you call somebody Black, most people now are too young to know this. But if you call somebody Black, I'm talking about, you know, you could be Black, because those would be the people who, you know, most of us live around other Black people. So somebody called you Black, that was like an insult. That was like, you know, that was like the N-word, you know, almost, right? And so all of these things that were connected to Black culture or Blackness that people use today were sort of symbolized within the context, within that by that word funk and the vernacular expression that it was associated with, the emotional fervor, the style, you know, the swagger, I guess, that people would use today. But, you know, these qualities that people, you know, that had been stigmatized. And that's something else to think about. You'd ask me about, you know, the whole intellectual thing. One of the important things about funk and what I try to do in this book is two things. One, so we tend to think almost solely in terms of racial discrimination as in terms of or how it relates to skin color. And that's certainly one basis, but probably a more fundamental basis has been the cultural component. And that was pretty much, you know, related to our religious practices and, you know, and the way we practiced our faith so that the spirit would come into the body. And, you know, you expressed that in body movement and dance, et cetera. Well, you know, that was considered, you know, ignorant and, you know, lewd, lascivious. People actually said this. I read eyewitness accounts. So there were, you know, the ring shout was lewd. That was a dance that people performed during slavery. This was lewd, lascivious, you know, essentially nasty. So you had all these different stereotypes. And so the implication was that there was that it was ignorant, right? You know, that, you know, it's just a bunch of foolishness. And the irony is that it was just the opposite, that these were epistemological mechanisms, that if you couldn't feel it, if you didn't move, you couldn't actually play the music or sing the songs the way they were supposed to be sung. You could not create the desired sound quality. And there's a there's a lot of evidence for this. But just, you know, one of the things that I point out in the book, Dizzy Gillespie, the famous trumpet player, said that that Illinois Jackett, I don't know if I'm mispronouncing his name, and Thelonious Monk, he said, these were two people who knew how to play my music because they knew how to move properly when they played my music. If a guy can't move properly, you know, he ain't got the feeling. That's a direct quote. He ain't got the feeling. And so that meant he couldn't play it, right? So you not only had to know the music and know the keys and the notes, you had to move and move properly. You understand? So one last thing about that. So in terms of, you know, funk, the term funkentelecky, you know, George Clinton's term, that's actually a fusion of two words. Entelechy means, you know, basically the actualization of something. So the full manifestation or actualization of an idea. So funk entelechy would be the full actualization of funk. And in order to understand and manifest that idea, you got to dance. You got to, it's something with the body. So that's what he means when he says we doing it in 3D. That's directly, that cuts directly against the basic presumptions of Western society, of Western, you know, much of Western philosophy.
Exactly. It has to be, you almost like the sanctity of emotion that comes from the experience of a people. And you see that there's a historical continuum of that. You see that in gospel music. You certainly see it in jazz with jazz improvisation, right? And it's, we'll change it. The changing saying, we will change it again because you cannot know this. To know this is to know our souls, really. And without this piece, and it becomes a way, I think, to sort of claim ownership, right? Because that it's like you said, to move the body. This is a part of who we are as a people. And so tell us some more about George Clinton's role here. And I know your discussion of George Clinton and Ishmael Reed and that point where he says, you know, read this. Have you ever read this, you know, particular piece?
Yeah.
Right.
There'll be a little bit more about this in my next book, which will focus on, you know, on literature. But more. So there's literature here, but I use it more so as historical reference. But I think the tie or the connection between those two artists is a direct has to do with epistemology. And so here's what I'll say to that, right? I've talked a little bit about, you know, funk and epistemology. So today there's a great deal of emphasis on the part of, you know, I see it in social media, scholars say it, sometimes I see poets, protests, right? Protest music, there's protest this, you know, protest. And I'm not opposed to protest. I actually, you know, was part of a group that confronted David Duke many, many years ago in person. So I understand protest. But from a cultural standpoint, that only gets us so far. So here's one way to think about this. Protest is what we oppose. Resistance is what we propose. And that means you have to have, that means that you have to come up with an alternative. So funk is a viable cultural philosophy that gives us a different set of values, a different viewpoint, different attitude, different aesthetic, a different ethos, ontology, and epistemology, right? It's the word funk means integrity, honesty at one's deepest emotion. So that's diametrically opposed to deceit and evil, which is essentially what we have right now in power, right? Deceit and evil go hand in hand. So, you know, just to give people, you know, a really clear, obvious kind of contrast in terms of the political implications. So I think that's at the core of, you know, that connection between Reed and Clinton. Mm-hmm.
Tell us some more about the women and the role that women play in the history of funk music and culture.
Well, let's see. A lot of women. And I think funk, because it was so contrarian, you know, rebellious, you know, just for the funk of it, so to speak, it attracted, you know, a lot of women artists. So you had Cynthia Robinson played trumpet. And Rose Stone played keyboards in Sly and the Family Stone. This was almost unheard of. You didn't see women instrumentalists in rhythm and blues at that time. Betty Davis, Chaka Khan. I, you know, devote chapters to Betty Davis and Chaka Khan. Max Dayan played piano with her husband Mandre. Let's see, LaBelle, the Pointer Sisters, Parlette, the Brides of Funkenstein, Joyce Baby Jean Kennedy, with Mother's Finest, Patrice Chocolate Banks, with Graham Central Station, Climax, all the Men All Pause, you know, let's see, Sheila E., Tina Marie, you could even argue Patrice Rushen as jazz funk, maybe. But there were a lot of women in funk.
So tell us about this phrase, organic intellectual. You use it in reference to Gil Scott-Heron. And tell us maybe how this, what do you mean by this label and how it applies to Heron?
Okay. Well, briefly, you know, I mean that, okay, generally in the book, I'm talking about the people who are creating music and their process. So a process that they're learning in what musician and musicologist Guthrie Ramsey calls community theaters, meaning living rooms, basements, churches, community centers, etc. So there's certain ideas, there's certain ways of playing, there's certain methods, there's certain objectives and criteria that they learn apart from, a university or a conservatory, et cetera. So that's what I mean generally. But when we talk about Gil Scott-Heron, I mean, and someone could say, well, you know, he doesn't really fit the traditional notion of the organic intellectual because he did get a master's degree in creative writing. But his style, he calls himself a bluesician or called himself. So he was really grounded in Black vernacular culture. Those were his standards. He would use, and he's different from people today in that regard. So he could go, he went to school and he would learn these different things, but he applied these concepts within the context of how to better reach Black people. So he was really, and he read immensely. He read political thinkers, not just, you know, a religious text here or there, or he had published two novels before he was 23 years old and then decided to reach people, you know, or that he could reach more Black folk through songs and poetry through recordings. But the other part about him, maybe the best way to think of this is because he was someone people talk now about calling something out. Gil Scott-Heron would explain something to you. He would explain why this was this way, and it made sense. And he used humor. And I think of people today, you know, I can't think of any of the comics who are actually on the scene right now who are funnier than he was. He would have people cracking up. But this was something that he learned, you know, in the neighborhood. It's not something he went to school for, you know. So maybe in that way, in terms of, you know, to answer your question.
Yeah, and it's interesting how you mentioned comics today who are known to sing and perform, and you would think somebody like Jimmy Fallon created the performance comic poet. But that's not the case. That comes out of the Black arts movement tradition.
Yeah, actually, interesting you say that. So Richard Pryor was a great singer. And before Pryor, he was really, you know, probably certainly one of the greatest comics, although, you know, in some of his views now, you know, we understand some of the contradictions in terms of, you know, homophobia. But before him, Burt Williams. Now I never saw Burt Williams, but I'm told that he was even better than Pryor, and he could do it all, you know, sing, dance, all of that, right? So yeah. I think, you know, what this particular logic explains is why we tend to gravitate toward performance, why we tend to express our most profound ideas in dynamic form rather than just a footnote. So it calls into question the presumption that all knowledge can be measured or documented within academic form. And obviously, the irony is that I'm writing in an academic form, but, you know, but I think that's really it, that, you know, and the implications are that, you know, we might actually find a better and more effective way of teaching our young people subjects like science, mathematics, or what have you, If we were to embrace the reality of the kinetic aesthetic that, you know, so many of us, sort of familiar with, you know, and conversant with.
I agree. And I think even in this idea of multiple intelligence theory is saying just that people learn in different ways. And we have to tap into that as educators. We have to figure out what type of learner or students are. So I think, like you said, these poets and writers of the BAM era and beyond are using their music to teach and produce knowledge beyond their audience. So I can definitely agree with that. So Dr. Bolin, we're sort of getting ready to wrap things up. So I want to leave some time for you to tell us about what's next for you in terms of your current and future research plans.
Well, thanks. I actually, you know, I envision this book as a real big book. So and publishers don't publish big, well, all publishers don't publish big books anymore. So I've envisioned funk as an aesthetic for quite some time. So the next book, what I'm working on now, is Funk Aesthetic in African American Literature. So, I'm writing about various writers in fiction, poetry, and how their works interface with, you know, various, you know, musicians and the concept of funk. So it'll be in some ways somewhat similar to my very first book, Afro Blue, which is what I thought I was going to write this time. But, you know, in that book, when I wrote that book, there were all kinds of material for blues and jazz. So all I had to do was apply those. And when I started writing about funk, there really wasn't a whole lot of material. So, so I had to actually create that. And so now I can go back and apply some of these things to some of the writers and visual art, you know. So that's the next book, at least one of the next. I'm also working on, I don't know if they're not memoirs, but, you know, autobiographical essays that I started during COVID, because I realized that the academic form, it would just, you know, when the pandemic hit, I just had all these different feelings and memories that came back, and I couldn't engage any of those. I couldn't, the academic form just wasn't, it didn't fit. And so I've been very productive. So I've got another kind of book. I don't know what that's going to be called. A term for it. I was around artists who actually were able to pinpoint, you know, the kind of politics or the political trajectory that led to what we're experiencing now. And I really haven't seen a lot of people, you know, talk about it in ways that were meaningful. So that's what I've been dealing with, in the last few months. And so that's going to be something I'm working on too.
Sounds like fascinating projects. And we look forward to reading your new books coming out. And, Dr. Bolin, we have taken up enough of your time this afternoon, but I wanted to thank you for participating in this interview about your important book, Groove Theory, The Blues Foundation of Funk.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome.